You're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. In this episode, I speak with a wonderful colleague, the bass trombonist Douglas Burden, who has recently retired from Canada's National Arts Centre Orchestra after 50 years. He shares his perspectives on his career, including wisdom passed down from some of his mentors, including Emery Remington and Arnold Jacobs, and the lessons he learned about staying healthy and keeping his playing at the highest level. Doug is also well known as an educator and will continue to teach at the University of Ottawa. He also shares his thoughts on what an orchestral career means, his memories of different conductors, his practice tips, and the importance of balancing different aspects of a life well lived. As well, I need to add that originally he had recorded part of a Bordoni vocalese, and technically that recording didn't work out. So what I'm including in the description is a separate link so you can hear his playing. And it was easier to leave the references to that into the conversation so that it flowed better. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Good morning, Doug Burden. Thanks so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
So you're retiring from our orchestra, the National Arts Centre Orchestra, as our bass trombone player of 50 years. Such an amazing accomplishment. Anyway, sure. Back to our conversation. You know, I bought this book of Bordoni vocalises many years ago. They've been printed for violin. And I asked our colleague, mm-hmm. Karen Donnelly, do you know these? And she said, are you kidding me? Of course. Like all the brass players, we all know those.
Yeah, it's everything from an instrumental music point of view, I think, is aimed to emulate the human voice. The human voice, I think, is maybe the most perfect instrument, and it has such a range of emotions and complexities and everything to go with it. So, what better instrument to emulate than the human voice? Is I think what we all mm-hmm. what we all aim for.
There's so many places we could go now, but I was just thinking about Jack Everly because your last concert mm-hmm. will be with him. And you mentioned the headphones switching to record. And he spoke with me last year on this podcast. So people who missed that might be curious because we talked a lot about accompanying movies and what it's like mm-hmm. for him on the podium.
Well, I think that I have many, many highlights, as you imagine, I've been going through in my memory over the past year. Yeah. And I don't think any one particularly stands out because there are so many highlights. And one of the highlights was with Jack when we accompanied the West Side Story movie, and the challenges that came with such difficult music and such complex music. It was just the fact that we were able to pull it off so successfully, and really, it's difficult music. But it's great music to play, but it's even more challenging to have to sync it up with what's on the screen, because as what Jack explained to us, and I'm sure he mentioned to you, is that when they spliced the film together, they were various takes of dance scenes, and those dance scenes weren't exactly at the same tempo with each take. So here Jack was having to adjust to the soundtrack, and we were faster, slower, faster. And I thought the orchestra did an incredible job at following Jack, of course.
Yeah, this brings me to one of my questions I have, because we sit at opposite ends of the orchestra, and the way our instruments are, I'm a violinist, so my attack is very immediate. But for you, I think there's a bit more of a delay, plus mm-hmm. you're way at the back. So how does that work?
We have to anticipate all of the time. I know with my mm-hmm. own playing and my own practicing and what I teach with my students, the production of the note is crucial. And words in teaching, I've discovered through the years, are so important. And it's interesting that you, as a violinist, use the term attack. I used to use that word attack, and I've tried to train my mind to say the word release, because the concept of attack can sometimes translate to a student aggression and point and accent, which isn't always important. But for us as wind players, as brass players, it's releasing the wind. And for my teaching and my own playing, it's to have an instantaneous response to that movement of wind. Once that's attained, then you have to compensate and anticipate when you play, because not only is there's this huge distance between us in the back row of the orchestra and the audience, that's not even to mention the conductor. But also the register that the pitches we play are much, much lower, and human ears don't detect those quite as quickly as frequencies in the upper spectrum. So we're constantly having to anticipate, and I think we've done a pretty good job with the low brass in the NAC, because it's a common problem with certainly amateur groups that trombones are behind, tubas are behind, and so yeah, it's part of the toolbox that we have to perfect, and it helps to have a good conductor, but knowing that you have to advance that. One thing was interesting is there are certain orchestras who purposely, because of what the conductor's gestures are, play in a delayed fashion. And if I can mention names, I would say that Mario Bernardi was one such conductor. There would be an ictus to his gesture, and then the sound would happen. And over the years, I've been fortunate enough to play extra with the Montreal Symphony Orchestra many times. And Charles Dutoit is exactly the opposite. And it was a huge adjustment to go from NACO to the OSM, who are right on the beat and the brass section that much in advance of the beat. It was, again, it was that computing that had to be changed.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, as a string player, I feel like we always play delayed, but less so with some conductors than others, for sure. There's always a change. And the more indistinct the beat, I think the later we all respond, because we want to make sure we feel it together. But I find that young string players coming in are always ahead. They're always coming in early. So it's the complete opposite. So Bernardi, I worked with him a little bit towards the end of his life, and I found... Yeah, he was unusually controlling. Like if he felt it sped up at all, he would immediately pull on the reins and we would kind of fall apart. Like he didn't want to go with, what we were doing. It was a very different, maybe old school approach.
I think your initial response was what is probably more accurate rather than old school, new school. Mm. And I know exactly what you mean and what his gestures were. And he would get very, indignant, that people weren't following his beat exactly. And I've got one little theory as to why that might be. And I could be wrong, but from my perspective, the history of the National Arts Center Orchestra, when it started in 1969, it was a small audience, but a great orchestra. So they could only really have one performance per week, and they were happy to fill the hall, because I can remember talking with Evelyn Greenberg, working so hard to fill the hall for the opening night, and they had to do that one concert every week for the duration of that particular season. And with the collective agreement, there were 8 services per week, which meant you had 7 rehearsals leading into one performance. What are you going to do in 7 rehearsals other than just rehearse it to death? So any degree of spontaneity would have been eliminated. But that's also became the hallmark of the NAC Orchestra. What is the incredible ensemble nature, the balance, the intonation? Because all of these things could be worked in a microscope almost for the 7 rehearsals leading up to what were fantastic 1 concerts per week.
Mm-hmm. And to contrast that with the way it has evolved, certainly pre-pandemic, we would sometimes be doing a recording, doing, like maybe 2 or 3 programs a week we'd have to have ready depending
Absolutely.
On the situation,
and
right?
that's where the orchestra has grown exponentially, grown musically, repertoire, abilities, being flexible. And I don't know whether you're going to lead down this road, but we're one of the few orchestras that not only play concerts on stage with mainstream orchestral repertoire, but we also were in the pit very often accompanying opera and ballet, and plus pops. Mm-hmm. So it's an extremely versatile group of musicians that that are in ACCO who are incredibly flexible and just amazing musicians.
So you were saying in your retirement speech the other night that the bass trombone is known for storms and graveyards, I guess low
yes,
brass in
yes.
general.
Well, it's the typecasting that comes with the sound of the instrument. And composers, mm-hmm. Earlier composers, took that typecasting to create these contexts, these atmospheres, which come very easily with the sounds of the trombones. So the storm scenes, the most classic storm scene is from William Tell, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Mm-hmm. And graveyard scenes, one of the earliest operas to use trombones was Don Giovanni by Mozart. And we are saved for the end of the opera, just a bit of professional background. Operas start usually at 8 o'clock at night. Don Giovanni lasts a little over 3 hours. Trombones enter the pit at 10:30 because we only play the very last end where Don Giovanni is being pulled into hell because of the sins of his life, and so those are the typecasting sounds that composers use for a long time. Fortunately, we have lost some of that typecasting element, more modern composers now feature what the possibilities and the technical capabilities of the instrument are. But it's this warm, rich, when we are playing loud and low, then it's harsh and aggressive. But we can also play very, very soft, and it's a very, very warm, mellow, almost a religious type of a sound with chorales. And the other thing mm-hmm. is trombones usually play in groups of three in a trombone section, so you get this blended chorale essence, which I think is, I love it. That's why I've been around for so long.
So tenor trombone is the usual trombone we think
Correct.
Of, right? It's called
Correct.
A tenor.
Go on.
And no, I was just curious. So trombone players, you would be learning both? Is that normal in university?
It's a very good question. Initially, that would be very, very true. As a high school trombonist, for example, you would learn the tenor trombone. And that would be the basis from which you might explore, okay, maybe I like the range and the sound of the bass trombone. Nowadays, as you get from high school into university, more and more tenor trombonists, in addition to playing tenor trombone, will also learn how to play bass trombone. If you hope to have an orchestral career as a tenor trombonist, you have to have the ability to also play alto trombone. And the trombone family, again, is very much akin to the human voice, because higher than the alto trombone, there is a trombone called the soprano trombone. And Karen Donnelly has one. And a few years ago, we did a chamber music program, and we featured a trombone ensembles, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, and a contrabass trombone. So these are registers that relate to the register and vocal range.
Do you have to transpose?
We don't
at
have
all?
To transpose, thank goodness, but we have to be able to play in different clefs. So the primary clef for trombone is bass clef. But with the traditions coming out of European publishing and learning solfège, you also have to be able to play in tenor clef and in alto clef. So they are all what we call C clefs. There's no transposition, but you visually have to make those adjustments. And Russian composers such as Rimsky-Korsakov in particular, Stravinsky, Prokofiev, they used to love to change from bass to tenor to alto clef. Now, the reason behind their thoughts is by using these different clefs, it would eliminate ledger lines, so you don't have to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 ledger lines to find out what pitch you're on. But when you're in the middle of a performance, it's very easy to kind of forget what clef you're in. So when someone makes a mistake, we'll whisper over and say, clef warp. You just had clef warp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we read a lot of ledger lines, or we have to read octave down in the first violins especially, and I write in the notes sometimes, like especially with my bad vision. It's just, is it five ledger lines?
That's what I do, being in the bass register, because there's no clef lower than the bass clef. But bass trombone, we're in pedal registers where it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, no, maybe five ledger lines. So yes, there are times when I definitely have to write in the name of the note, because the other thing that happens when you play low, very very low, and particularly very very loud, you begin to hyperventilate, and so the vision begins to blur and the lines begin to shake like that. And even though you're in great shape, that's a physiological thing that we have to deal with, and have to make sure that when you walk on stage, you don't have an empty stomach, because you'll faint otherwise. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that brings me to Arnold Jacobs. So what did he say? The song and the wind. And why don't you explain who he was?
Well,
he
was a legendary brass pedagogue whose reputation actually went beyond the brass world into woodwind players and also some singers. Arnold Jacobs and my adoption of his concepts came late in my education. I did not actually start studying with him until I was graduated from the Eastman School of Music and already playing in Ottawa. And his secret was he was able to, he himself knew the complexities of the anatomy, the medical, the physiological aspects of playing, but he was able to encapsulate and distill something of complexity into very, very simple concepts. And so it's the books often say wind and song, but if he were to write the books, he would say song first and the wind makes it happen. I guess from a literary person, wind and song rolls off the tongue easier. So with our wonderful brains as human beings, we have this ability to analyze. And he knows that, and one of his pet phrases was, analysis leads to paralysis. And what he tried to do was to simplify things as much as possible. Very, very complex concepts, but with a very simple musical approach. And every person that studied with Arnold Jacobs would have a different take from him, because he was such a master teacher. He was able to analyze your strengths and weaknesses immediately within the first 15 minutes. In my first lesson with him, the first thing that he asked me to do was to play a melody from memory. I don't want you to read anything. I just want you to play your most favorite melody. And within an instant, he had sized me up. And then prescribed different exercises, different approaches, different concepts to help. He had a wide array of breathing devices which could help visualize what it is you were doing. Speaking of visualizing, one of his tools is this device, which is a mouthpiece visualizer. So this is mm-hmm. what it looks like and sounds like in the raw sound. So this is where the pitches are created. And if someone was having embouchure problems, that would help to visualize it.
So if I could just ask, where you weren't singing buzzing. There, you were yeah. just buzzing the pitches?
There are some teachers, Elaine Trudel, the famous Canadian trombonist, uses what's called free buzzing. So this is the wind moving forward, and the embouchure, which is a fancy word to describe all the many muscles making up this part of our facial mask, it's the degree of tightening and relaxing that creates the change of the pitch. So with some people, if you get analyzing, then you start thinking of muscle, this muscle, that muscle. Arnold Jacobs says, no, it's mm-hmm. the melody, it's the song. And by trial and error and by repetition and by always aiming to play beautifully, the body will eventually figure it all out. You actually get in the way if you analyze it.
So he his lungs were compromised by childhood asthma, as
yes,
understand.
Asthma, senior moment, emphysema, it was. And So he knew he had this condition, and emphysema, as I understand it, and I'm no expert, is a condition where the elasticity of one's lungs gets lost as you age. So the ability to expand and contract reduces. So knowing this as a younger man, he made it his mission to investigate through medicine and also psychologists the interaction of the body and the mind. The other interesting background to Arnold Jacobs when he was a student at the Curtis Institute of Music is he was a double major. He was a voice major and a tuba major, and he had to make a choice which to follow, because when you sat in his studio and heard him speak with you, it was this most richest, roundest baritone bass voice. You could easily see and picture him on the stage in an operatic role, and I think he made the right choice.
Yeah, so he played with Chicago Symphony exactly. for most of his career.
One neat little story is when he was a student at Curtis, Fritz Reiner, the famous conductor of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, was the conductor of the student orchestra of Curtis. And the practice room, because each student had their own room assigned to them, happened to be very, very close to the corridor which linked the Curtis School to where the Philadelphia Orchestra performed on stage. So all of these amazing musicians and conductors would pass in front of his practice room on a daily basis, which then elevates one's expectations of what you are doing. Another one of his pet phrases that he would tell me is, Doug, stop practicing and begin performing. Because one of the unsaid rules or elements about practicing is we all give ourselves a second chance or a third chance. But practicing by repetition will improve. Sometimes practicing only perfects your mistakes, but if you begin performing and expecting that each time you play, even if it's just a whole note or a scale, it's a scale that's going to be performed on Southam Hall stage. It really changes your expectation of of your own performance.
Yes, and actually, you may not know this, but there's all these clips of him teaching people on YouTube, which I
Nice,
was
nice.
listening to. So, yeah, so some of these stories. And one thing I really thought was great is he said, don't talk to students about changing their bad habits. When you notice a bad habit, just talk about what they need, the new
Exactly.
habit.
I should actually check out those YouTube clips, because
Yeah.
I was unaware of that. Thank you for letting me know. Yeah, he was legendary because he was unique, and he didn't try to fit you into his mold. He would take you where you were and take you to the next level. And it really was inspiring. And I do have to thank the Canada Council for allowing me to make the flights to Chicago and to pay the expenses to have that added value learning after I had my degree and I was already playing with the orchestra.
Yeah, so you were let's go back and talk about your beginning. So you
Yes,
started
okay.
on the cornet, like a lot of kids. And then when they needed a trombone player, they're like,
That's right.
take
That's
this
right.
thing. And your parents were pastors with the Salvation Army Church, so you grew up with this very rich musical tradition of singing and
Very, very
brass
much so.
playing. Is that right?
While I was in the womb, I was probably exposed to all of this music and it's things that I took for granted as a young boy and never analyzed. But as I look back now, I said, "Wow, what an opportunity! What an experience! These are things that I was able to absorb without even knowing what I was what was coming into my mind and my body. And I'm eternally grateful to my parents for that. And my mother was a lovely singer and a very fine pianist. I can remember in high school, as a grade 13 student back in the days when they had grade 13, I played this sonata for bass trombone, and my mom accompanied me on the piano. She was that good of a pianist. My dad was a brass player and actually a trombone player. Actually, let me just get this. Coming out of the tradition of the Salvation Army, which embraced the British brass band system, the bass trombone in a brass band was called a G trombone. Let me show you one. This is pitched in G. Most tenor trombones and bass trombones are pitched in B flat. And there are seven positions on a trombone, and the only way that you could reach the sixth and seventh position is this device, which is called the handle. And in the Midlands of England, it was called G mid handle. So I can barely even move it. I can't move it past there. But that's the instrument that my father played in the brass band.
So, your parents were supportive
Yes,
of you going into
yes,
music
yes.
professionally.
We didn't have a lot of money, and what money they had left over, they were very, very generous. As I look back on, money that they could have spent on themselves, they put towards lessons. They put towards books. They sacrificed for me and also my sisters. And I'm ever grateful for what they poured into me with that, and certainly all of the lessons that they by their own lives I was able to see, but also in the environment of the Salvation Army, that the brass band is a very strong influence. And being around very, very good brass players at a young age, I'm a real believer in learning by osmosis. And I think that's what we experienced the last 3 weeks with our mentorship program, is that having these young fine instrumentalists sitting next to us, we can talk as much as we want, but when they sit next to you and they see you and they hear you perform and how you perform and how you approach, these are concepts which can't be put in words, but they are huge learning moments.
Yeah. So when you went to Eastman, which is a really wonderful school and very expensive, you did get support from the church. You were able to work
well,
there.
Well, actually,
to help.
The support didn't come from the church. The support came from someone by the name of Charlie Baker, who was also in the Salvation Army, and he heard me as a high school student and said, "Doug, you need to go to Eastman during the summer session and study with Emery Remington." So in the summer between my grade 12 and my grade 13 year, I went to Eastman for the six-week course, and took weekly lessons with Emery Remington. And if I didn't have my 1 hour lesson with Remington, I was practicing, just practicing. And at the end of that 6 weeks of courses in the summer session, in my final lesson, he leaned over to me, and Chief is what his students call him. He said, "Would you like to study with me?" And of course I said, "Yeah, I would love to study." He said, "Leave it with me." And I didn't have to take an audition. I was given a full tuition scholarship and started. So
okay.
There were still expenses that had to be met, such as room and board and travel and books and that. And back then, there was a Canada student loan for students who were Canadian studying abroad. And I took out loans, and it worked out.
Yeah. So, you know, I was thinking the summer festivals I did when I was younger, it made such a huge impact. What was that like going that first time to something like that?
It was incredible. The broad-based ensembles that would have taken place during a normal academic year were not evident during the summer session, but was focused on the summer session was jazz. And the level of the playing of the students and the arrangers and the conductors in that jazz program was just off the charts. I had never heard anything like that. The other thing was, during the summer session, Emery Remington still continued to rehearse his trombone choir once every week. Mm-hmm. And students who had graduated and had jobs in orchestras suddenly in the summer were able to come back and reunite with Remington and joined the trombone choir. And I could still remember those rehearsals. We had 30 trombonists in a large horseshoe, and the sounds that 30 talented trombonists under the direction of Remington, I had endorphins flying up and down my spine. It was glorious sounds and experiences I had never had. So, just as you mentioned, they just fueled my imagination, fueled my motivation, and are just treasured memories for sure.
So, what were you working on in that summer if it was focused on jazz? Were you learning how to improvise, or were you also working on orchestral excerpts?
The jazz element were the rehearsals and the concerts that were open to the public. Mm-hmm. I was never a jazzer. I don't call myself a jazzer. I don't improvise, and I'm totally in awe of those who are able to, and also do the classical and the jazz together. So this was just, again, opening a window on my experience, which I'd heard through recordings, but never live. My own personal focus in my personal practice was to prepare what Remington had asked me to do during the lessons. So that was the dichotomy, the classical and the jazz, but very, very, very complementary at the same time.
You're very well regarded as a teacher, and I'm happy to hear you'll still be teaching at the University of Ottawa. What of your mentors? You've already talked about Arnold Jacobs and Mr. Remington. What do you bring of their teaching into your teaching, and how has that changed over
the years?
Excellent
question. Excellent question. And I was forced by the early death of Emory Remington, who actually passed away very suddenly, in the first semester of my studies at Eastman, to still keep going and still keep learning. I was continually asking questions of the students at Eastman who had studied with Remington, and picking their brains and making the most that I could. The teacher that followed Emory Remington at Eastman was Donald Knobb, K-N-A-U-B. And he was a bass trombonist. Prior to taking over the trombone studio, he was a tuba teacher, and it was the tuba teacher of two very, very famous tuba players, Roger Bobo and Dan Parentoni. So for the tuba world, they will know those names. So Don Knobb was a great teacher, was a great bass trombonist, and for me, helped to fill in the nuts and bolts of the orchestral repertoire and the bass trombone solo repertoire. Studying with Arnold Jacobs was the conceptual elements. And so I think my teaching has evolved through the year in a very hybrid form, taking the basic lyrical relaxation singing concepts of Emory Remington to the very precise technical aspects of Donald Knobb, and then the overall growing as an artist through Arnold Jacobs. And I'd like to think that I've taken the best from each of those and applied them to my individual students for what they need.
That must have been a terrible shock when Emory Remington died. Were you in school? Was it,
yes,
like,
it was.
During the semester?
It was December 7th, 1971. It was a Friday. There was a wind ensemble concert. He had, I think, he was 79 years of age. And at that time, he had a studio of 25 students. And he had taught right until supper time.
Wow.
On that Friday. He went out for supper with Donald Hunsberger, the conductor of the wind ensemble, a former student of Remington's, and died suddenly at supper of a heart attack. And everyone showed up for the evening concert. I was still just a freshman at the time, so I would have been in the audience. But all of my trombone buddies and everyone else were there in their formal tails, and suddenly word came around. It was just, it was cathartic. It was very, very sad, very sad.
And when you were 19, when you started at Eastman, you already had come to play in Ottawa. You got a gig,
yes,
here.
Yes. What it was, I started at Eastman in September of 1971 as a freshman, first-year student in the Canadian parlance. And at that time, Gordon Cherry, who everyone knows in the trombone world, was a master's student. Gordon is from Toronto, Ontario, and had the benefit of having worked with Remington for so many years. And Gordon had already started playing in Ottawa when a tenor trombonist and a principal trombonist was needed. So we go turn the calendar page into 1972, but it's still my first year. And this particular program came up, and it was the Liszt Piano Concerto Number 1. It required a trombone section. And the trombonist, the bass trombonist that they had been using, was a freelancer from Toronto. And I think that individual probably had a better series of gigs that he wanted to stay in Toronto. And the second trumpet player of NACWA at the time and personnel manager was Bob Oates. So Bob Oates asked Gordon Cherry, "Gordon, do you know a bass trombonist that we can hire for this concert?" And Gordon Cherry not really knowing my playing, went to Amory Remington and said, hey, there's a concert coming up. Do you think Doug can play the concert? And Remington said, sure, he can do it. And that's how it started, February of 1972.
Mm-hmm. How far
a
drive is it?
It's about a five-hour drive when the weather is good. For those of you who know the geography of our area, to drive from Rochester to New York, you drive from Rochester to Syracuse. You head north from Syracuse to Watertown, and that was where the really dangerous road was, because that road, Interstate 81, is in the lee of Lake Ontario. So in the middle of winter, whatever storms were brewing only picked up more moisture off the lake and dumped all the snow right there around Watertown, and then 401, and then north to Ottawa. But back then, there was not a four lane road connecting the 401 to Ottawa. So it was a lot of driving. There was one period in my in my senior year where I had numerous concerts and rehearsals in Ottawa, but also a recital to prepare and rehearse in Rochester. And I think it was in the span of 10 days that I did three round trips. When you look back, youth is crazy. But when you're young, you're able to do it because you can recover. You know, it's just, you just do it.
Yeah. So actually, not everyone listening will know that our orchestra is smaller. So when you said they needed a trombone section, we don't have the full complement of brass and winds that bigger symphony orchestras have.
Certainly that was the case in the early years. Yes, it was very much a classical size orchestra, meaning pairs of woodwinds and brass without a full-time trombone section. But the irony of it, is that the very first concert that the orchestra played was in the pit accompanying the National Ballet of Canada in the Prokofiev Romeo and Juliet. And guess what? They needed low brass and a full complement of horns. So Colin Traquair calls it the inconvenient truth of the National Arts Center Orchestra. Yes, on paper, those are the full-time positions, but in reality, trombones and other augmenting instruments have had to be hired from day one. I can remember playing one program with NACO. I was still a student, and it might have been my second or third year, but Gene Watts was playing second trombone to Gordon Cherry, and Gene Watts for many, many years was a trombonist in the Canadian Brass, and on my left was Chuck Dahlenbach, the tuba player from the Canadian Brass. So these larger sections were required on a regular basis, and what the orchestra found is when you have an ad hoc system of hiring people, it turns into a revolving door and there's no uniformity of sound. So that's when they tried to hire the same people over and over again. And it was finally, thanks to Pinchas Zukerman, who said, enough is enough, we have to provide contracts and security and benefits. So I'm very thankful for him.
Yeah, that must have been a game changer, because I don't think you had sick leave
before
that.
Didn't have sick leave, didn't have benefits, no dental, no medical, no glasses. We were only paid when we played, so our income went up and down like this. So when you get a contract, then you're able to move it. And I remember Pinchas telling me, in his earliest years as a music director, you with your orchestra went to the Middle East and to Israel on tour, right?
I actually stayed behind with our older daughter, who was a toddler, but
fair enough.
Yeah.
Pinchas told himself, and he told the management when he got back from that tour, he said, I'm never touring again unless I can bring trombones with me. So there was certain repertoire that he wanted to feature the orchestra with, and it was limiting to his artistic choices, not having trombones. And people had talked about it for a very, very long time. But as you know, and I know, Pincus would never take no for an answer. And he willed it into happening.
So the contract, I was discussing this with Mark, my husband, I think it was just like a page, our collective agreement, when things started, and now it's like a thick, thick book. What changes have you noticed in terms of our working conditions that have improved, that are important?
Working
that
conditions
time?
Improvement. This is a question I hadn't anticipated. Let me think.
Maybe they've gotten worse. I don't know.
What I think has happened is maybe situations that had slipped through the cracks previously were identified and codified and improved. I think in terms of travel when touring, I think that has been improved greatly. The process of the auditioning process is modernized and made much more fair now than what it ever was. That is a huge positive element. The work density, I think those elements have been improved and maybe can still be improved, because there were times I can remember, certainly within the string section under a previous music director, where, as you mentioned earlier, we would have two or three programs in the same week, and it just burned out the string players. That there was all kinds of tendonitis problems and other problems, and those I think have been addressed. Obviously, pay has improved. It is a lot better.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned about auditions. So since the pandemic, we have now started having our first rounds are recordings that people send in, which I applaud in that it's very expensive for people to be doing auditions. And our country is so huge. It's very prohibitive. So that levels the playing field. But then again, everyone uses different recording setup. I heard there's issues with people having terrible internet and just time to upload their recordings can be an issue. Do you have any perspective on that change in our profession? Because it seems to be something that's here to
stay.
Well,
from a conceptual point of view, I can see, certainly as you prefaced it, being in the pandemic, I think that was a very, very useful thing. Because the first time that it was employed in a brass audition was for my position, I have purposely kept it at arm's length without getting too much in the detail, because I did not in any way want to have a candidate be accused of having insider knowledge or whatever, and so I rose above it. But I have heard from other colleagues who are on the committee, the bass trombone audition committee, having seen, actually they didn't see it, having heard the first round, that it was a very uneven representation of the candidates. And having spoken to some candidates after the fact, they were very, very frustrated that their own abilities were not represented well by this recorded process. And I think it has merits, but I think it also has flaws. And it's not for me to decide what to do as we go on. I think that's why one of the things that I love about NACO is there is a process. And I do believe in process. No process is perfect, but it's better than nothing. And I have absolute confidence in your experience and knowledge and feelings and the collective experience of everyone who is on the committee to sit down and say, okay, do we want to follow this? Yes or no? If we do want to follow it, what improvements have to be made? And if we don't, let's go back to the old model. But you're absolutely right. For a student, traveling and hotel and meals to come to an audition where you might play 10 minutes, that's a huge investment.
Yeah. So you coach university students. You must be dealing with
Yes.
audition preparation all the time. What kind of preparation do you do with them, and what kind of advice do you give them?
Preparation, preparation, preparation. And it's learning and assimilating what it is that you need to prepare. And also trying to let them know what's behind the screen, you know, what the Wizard of Oz is listening to on the far side of the screen. And that's why I really stress, first of all, sound. That's the most important thing, because you aren't going to be seen as an individual when you're when you're behind the screen. Sound, intonation, rhythm. Those, if you don't have those three, don't even bother showing up. After that, then it's studying each excerpt from the inside out, not just superficially for the bass trombone, but you have to listen to at least three different recordings of the same work and have the full score in front of you and recognize where you're doubling, where you're in octaves, maybe the occasional solo moment, but you have to know the context so that when you do perform that very short excerpt, the person who is on the committee will be able to hear the orchestra in their ears as you are playing your single line. Mm. And without that context, I don't think you'll get past the first round. Because then I also stress, you have to prove that you are a musician first and a trombonist second. There are lots of trombonists and instrumentalists who, it's like a dog and pony show. They are technical geniuses, but they don't say anything. It's just, it's two-dimensional. So yeah. I know that I've said a lot, and that's why it takes many lessons to prepare for an audition. And then when you're getting close to that audition, I will get very, very strict and very, very tough. And, sorry, there's no way that you can touch that first note to get a pitch. You have to have it in your inner ear. And that's where your solfege and that's where your singing comes to bear. And you've only got one chance. You have to focus it. And then you have to be able to switch gears 2 seconds later, 5 seconds later, go from Mozart to Wagner, to Shostakovich, to Prokofiev, to Tchaikovsky. And you have to be able to make those musical changes because your imagination is vivid enough to create it. Going back to my first lesson with Arnold Jacobs, Arnold said, "Doug, can you imagine what the taste of a chocolate ice cream cone is?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "If you have an imagination, then you can be an artist." But he used the taste of chocolate ice cream. So that's how I approach students that come to me for audition preparation.
Let's talk about intonation. Violinists might know I have 23 videos I've made about intonation pitfalls, because for us it's our life, you know, and I think a lot of us have perfectionistic tendencies because it's so hard to play in tune. And like the trombone, we shift, you know, we have to change positions. I'm curious about
right.
that parallel, actually. So I'm curious,
no.
Do you have perfect pitch?
And
I don't
either. And between you and me, I'm glad that I don't have perfect pitch, because people who I played with who have perfect pitch, I can't play in tune with them. Because show me an orchestra or an ensemble that has perfect pitch, you know. Relative
yeah.
pitch, yes, but not perfect pitch.
Yes, I find it's very interesting. And I think, as I tell my students, because I use my relative pitch, I have to be on top of intervals. You have to hear the intervals. And people have perfect pitch, they just go with what
mm-hmm.
they think they know the note is. And they can't adjust to what, as you're
yeah,
saying, the pitch
yeah.
changes.
So
yeah.
the technological revolution that's occurred in our lifetime, I am a techie. I love gadgets. I love trying to stay up with techniques. And for me, the tuners I've used since they came out, one of the earliest ones, and a very good one, is this Korg tuner. All right, and this has the ability to show in a metered reading whether you're flat or sharp according to the where you set as a pitch standard, and that's a whole other discussion, is it? And we with NACO choose to be at 440. yes. Yeah.
Not really.
it's a point of departure. With the OSM, when I was playing with them under Dutoit, they choose to have 442, but as soon as they start playing, it goes zoom way up. All right, and so that there are certain considerations for brass players, and you know what, where are you going to put your tuning slide? For reed makers, oboe players, and bassoonists, they have to make reeds according to the pitch. Anyways, I'm getting off topic, but yes. Yes, the trombone is very, very similar to string instruments in that we don't have buttons and keys which set a particular pitch which we might have to adjust as a performer. But for us, it's the combination of the buzz that I just showed you, the wind speed, and where you're going to place the slide. Temperature comes into the play too. Fatigue comes into the play. And by having electronic devices which are they are umpires without emotions. They will tell you if you're flat or you're sharp or you're in tune. And I like to use the equal temperament settings, and my device of choice right now is the TE tuner, or the tonal energy tuner. And that's one of the images that you can see. It also has a metronome as part of the software. It's got a recording device. And for me, droning the pitch audibly is a very, very, very good way of doing it. Because as a bass voice, as a bass trombonist, I look at part of my job description as providing a reliable bass sound, whether it's the tonic of the chord or the fifth of the chord, occasionally the third, but usually the third is somewhere higher in the section. But something which is reliable and not going to creep up or be artificially low, because you get some bass players who think, well, to be a bass, you end up just playing flat. Well, that's wrong. And so, yeah, tuning is a huge, huge, huge personal element that I force upon myself. And it's important that you keep your inner ear calibrated, because often tuning, in amateur groups certainly, the loudest is the rightest, but that's not right. Yeah.
So when you say playing with drones, you mean like there's a drone sounding
that's
and you tune
against
that.
That's correct. And yeah. This tuning app that I just showed you, the TE tuner, can generate the tone audibly, and at the same time have the graphic representation of whether you're flat or sharp. Now, getting this is related, but it's an interesting sidebar. Playing a brass instrument, 50 years in NACO, but I was playing brass prior to that, degrades the ability of the ear to hear, and I have gradually lost hearing over the years, and I use hearing aids, so here they are there. And they are wonderful hearing aids. They're not cheap. They're quite expensive. But they are Bluetooth compatible. So when I'm practicing at home using this tuner, I will have the drone going into my hearing aids. No one else can hear them, but I can hear them. And then I can make sure that what I'm hearing and what I'm playing lines up. And you could You don't have to have hearing aids to do that, but buds will do that, or a bud, whatever you're comfortable doing. But that's how I really am able to prevent myself from playing too flat or too sharp, because having this device will not make you play, will not make you play in tune. It will show you when you're playing out of tune. And again, getting back to the song and wind, when you have a better idea of what that pitch is, then you will be able to play it. Then we talk about temperament, thirds and sevenths and ninths. We could probably talk for an hour about that, because those aren't equally tempered changes in pitch. But when you use your ear, you can hear the untunefulness of equally tempered pitches. Again, with this device, you can have three or four or five or six pitches going at the same time, making chords, if you want.
Yeah, the one I use doesn't do that.
TE
I should check
tuner.
that out. Okay. So let's talk about endurance. I know a lot of your practicing must be to develop endurance, both of your embouchure and
Yes,
just physically.
absolutely. And the other thing, I don't know whether most of your viewers in the of your podcast might tend to be string players in an orchestra as a string player. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Basically, you're playing every piece in the program almost, and playing all the way through every piece. So when you get home, yes, you have to practice, but it's not for endurance because you're actually quite tired. The function of the trombone, which we referred to earlier, there are great swaths of time, depending on the period, where we are counting rests. And all that does is our muscles atrophy. If you don't use them, you lose them. So when I get home, I have to practice. Just ask my wife. She's so happy I'm retiring. I'm sick and tired of hearing a bass trombone practicing. But that's what we have to do. Because we are sitting counting rests, we're not involved. We're watching, we're listening, we're musically engaged, but we're not physically engaged. So when you go home, yes, endurance with flexibility. Because if you practice too hard, too long, your muscles, for lack of a better term, get brittle. They get tense. And you don't want tension in your muscle or a part of your body. So there is endurance. It has to be built up gradually. Students of mine that view this will know that I often use the example of if you want to run a marathon and you've never wanted and you've never run before, you have to learn how to walk around the block. Then walk around the block two times and gradually build up. And that's how endurance is built. Just wishing it or suddenly imposing it upon your body, your body will rebel, and you can injure yourself very, very, very quickly. And I've known brass players that have seriously injured their embouchures. The other thing about endurance for a trombonist is we're required to hold this instrument up for extended long times. So all of the strength appears to be on the left-hand side of the body. And just as with string technique, you have to keep your instrument stable in this position, whatever it happens to be, but it has to be stable. Because if I were to take my mouthpiece to go, oh, that's not going to work. So that there has to be a consistency, and that strength for trombonists, the big as you begin to age, and you lose the strength and flexibility of being a teenager and a young man or a young woman. Tendonitis begins to set in. And to avoid tendonitis, because I've had three severe bouts of it throughout my career. And as you mentioned earlier, I was playing through tendonitis because if I didn't play, I didn't get paid. And so what you have to do is you have to strengthen all of your body. It isn't just the left-hand side, which is holding the trombone, but the muscles on the right side of your body, almost every muscle in your body has a left-right pairing. And they assist in stabilizing and strengthening one another. So to just do exercises on the left hand isn't going to work. You have to do both, and you have to combine. But yes, endurance and strength and conditioning are essential. And it gets harder when you get older. That's just a simple fact.
I remember once you were telling me how you had these planks that you do, that you work into your practice time.
Okay.
I found that fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, when I had my last problem with tendonitis, I started going to the Active Health Institute here in Barrhaven and got some excellent physical instruction above and beyond the physiotherapy to help relieve the pain symptoms. It doesn't remove the pain, it helps the symptoms, because only time will heal. But this personal trainer gave me a whole series of exercises to do to help strengthen various parts, and planks, stretching is something that I do as an older person now. Free weights, working on my elliptical for wind and endurance, but yeah, it's keeping muscles strong. Planks, there's all kinds of exercises which I do sequentially, and the thing is to not push yourself, but to still do it.
Yeah, consistency. But I guess at some point, yeah, we must have been talking in the green room or something, and it was interesting to me because as part of your breaks to give your embouchure a break, you would incorporate some of the strengthening, which I thought was brilliant.
Well, thank you. It's something which I do, and I think that I'm a better player as an older person than I was as a young man, because we take for granted what can happen, and the recovery period of a young body is instantaneous, overnight almost. But that's not the case as we work our way through these decades.
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about coaching students for auditions, and I know that it's more accepted now if people take drugs such as beta blockers when they're presented with a high stakes situation. Is that a discussion you sometimes have?
No. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, good or bad. I personally haven't looked into it. I have superficially read articles, and I don't want to come down too hard against it, because I'm no expert, and I do know that everyone is different. So if it's something that an individual finds can be helpful, then I'm not going to say don't do it, do it. From my perspective, from my personal experience with the students that I've had, I would prefer to stay as natural as possible with your body. One of the things that I tell my students is avoid stimulants. Don't drink a lot of coffee, because when you drink coffee, that's when your hand can shake. Avoid eating snack food which has raw sugar, and your blood sugar levels will go high and you'll feel great, but what happens is they just go right off the bottom. What you need to have is stability, predictability, and I think everything has been given to us in our body and in our mind, that if we are good stewards of our body and mind, they will see us through. Now, psychologically, how we train our mind for these audition situations, I think it can be trained. I think it's conditioned training, it's behavioral training, but always with a very positive dare I say, holistic approach to it rather than an artificial way of taking care of it. That's my own thoughts.
Yeah. Well, it concerns me too, because of course, let's say you get the job, then you're on probation for a couple of years and every rehearsal is high stakes. And if you feel like you need to take something to slow down your heart rate, that can be a scary sort of situation.
Absolutely.
Of dependency, I think.
Yeah. And one medication with which brass players do take occasionally, and I myself do, and that is Advil, because what it helps to do is it helps to reduce the inflammation of muscles and joints, and mm-hmm. particularly brass players of small mouthpieces, trumpet players and horn players, where there's a great mm-hmm. deal of not that they press, but they're just playing all the time. For example, we just finished four performances of Sleeping Beauty in 3 days, wasn't it? It was like Thursday, Friday, and two on Saturday. That's a three-hour opera of a lot of playing. And ballet, thank you.
Ballet, yeah.
And brass players at the end of that stretch will pop an extra strength Advil before you go to bed at night to help reduce the swelling. So there I have already contradicted myself, because I've introduced something, but it does work. Now, if you took an Advil every night, then that's when it's going to be a problem, because it's actually banned in some countries in Europe where you have to have a prescription for Advil. Yeah, because it's not good for your liver. Basically.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wanted to see, oh yeah. So just talking about this health thing and mindset, do you have like a good routine for like after concert wind down so you can get enough sleep? And
that's an excellent question, Leia. Very good. And for someone who isn't a performing professional musician, you might not have even considered that, but it is a reality. Our work, we have to be at our peak in a performance at 10 o'clock at night, maybe 10:15, when the biggest, loudest, most exciting part of the final piece of the concert is. That's when most people are already in bed. As a brass player, I've been told that inhaling and exhaling all of these, this large quantity of air stimulates a particular hormone in the system, plus you're hungry, and one is often ravenous when you get home. I am, because you're really pumping out a lot of sound. What we did with the Mahler 1, just incredible amount of energy. So that's where you have to make wise choices. I would say that in my middle career, I didn't make good choices and I gained a lot of weight. And when you gain a lot of weight, you lose strength, you lose endurance, you lose energy. And I went on a diet, and I really, a diet consisting of changing what I ate and also much more exercise. So when I do get home, what I will eat will be vegetables, celery, lettuce. I'm not perfect. Occasionally, I will nibble on some French fries. But it's either water or Diet Coke. I know some people over the years, and I'm not going to say who or why or point fingers, will drink a little too much, because it helps bring them down from the very wonderful highs that we have as performers playing great works of art. You can't help be excited. If you aren't excited, you shouldn't be there. So. But again, I guess one of my little mantras might be everything in moderation. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't drink. I enjoy having a beer after some concerts, but not after every concert. And with some people, I think the one beer might wear off and it comes into two beers, and maybe two beers and a scotch. And then you wake up the next morning and, I think in moderation, but
Yeah.
avoid the sweets, avoid the starches late at night. Read. That's what I do. I like watching reruns of Law and Order because they're neat stories, and it's and often they're true elements. But it is a tough time of the day for us as performers, because we're hungry, we're thirsty. We can't go to sleep, because if you go to sleep, you've got these earworms of hearing the piece over and over. So it's bring yourself down. Yeah. Moderation.
Yeah, and when we have young children, it's extra hard.
I have a picture of myself, oh, many years ago, and I was holding our newborn Jennifer. And Stephanie was maybe 6 years of age, and I had bags under my eyes. And these are years when you have children, have them when you're young, because you go through years of sleep deprivation. There's no question. But would I change what I did? Absolutely not. They're what makes life complete. Family, for sure.
Yeah. So in terms of your years at the in the orchestra, Franz Paul Decker, I believe, was one of your favorite
Yes,
conductors to work with.
he was so unique. He never followed any mold that I was able to predict or able to see. And with all of his gruff exterior, and he was very gruff, for sure, particularly for someone who wasn't a good musician and wasn't performing, he would find that flaw and he would poke at the scab. But I think he was still a very sensitive conductor and an absolute musician to the core. I can remember one favorite piece that the orchestra used to play often was the Richard Strauss Le Bourgeois Gentium Suite. Well, that is a suite from a larger work, which is an opera, Der Burger's, pardon my German, Der Burger aus Eidelmann. And we did the whole opera as we used to do yearly, an opera on stage. And it's scored for one trumpet, one trombone, two horns, and double winds. Got a big bass trombone part. And I remember him coming back and sitting next to me talking about the bass trombone part, because Franz Paul Decker actually knew Richard Strauss. He actually played cards with Richard Strauss in Strauss's older age. So he was able to impart to me things being handed down, which were so revealing. And then we did some scenes. Then we did a Rosenkavalier suite with them, and I think Jesse Norman was the guest for that gala, and we did the final act of Capriccio. So here he was conducting Strauss the way Strauss wanted it. And yes, he was gruff. Sometimes you could never understand what his baton was doing by our very modern standards, but there was emotion coming from the baton and not time. And so yeah. Now, ask me whether I would want him as a music director. I think I would say no, but as a regular guest conductor, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, I remember I did do I've been playing for 27 years at this point, and I did quite a few shows with him, and yeah, that intensity that he could impart and the indistinctness caused us to listen very well, I felt.
Well, there was a pianist who used to play with us, Rolf Berst. Do you remember him? He was based in Montreal. Now he's living and performing and conducting in Calgary. And if I can paraphrase what he said, he said Deckard wasn't necessarily the best rehearser, but what his gift was, he was able to synthesize the moment in a performance. He was able to bring everything to bear, and wham, that it just happened. It was that ability to make music of the moment and not to try to, I won't say anything more about other conductors.
Yeah. So do you have a large collection of scores? You talked about score study before.
I started to do that as a young student, but no, I rely on digital sourcing for my scores rather than personal purchases. Yes.
Well, now it's so easy.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
But I strongly encourage that, for sure. And the scores that I did have were the scores of the Tchaikovsky symphonies. I've got those. Mm-hmm. There was a period where I went through a Vaughan Williams phase, and I bought scores for the Vaughan Williams symphonies. I think I'm probably one of the few people in NAC who has actually listened to all of the Vaughan Williams symphonies, because they're a bit of an acquired taste, and you either love them or you hate them, I think.
So your preparation time that you budget every day, does that include listening to recordings, or is that separate from the actual practicing of the trombone?
That's a very good question. On a daily basis, I always try to get up very, very early. A light breakfast, stretching, and then I do my basic warm up. My listening occurs in my car. I've always transferred back into the days of LPs. I would put something on cassette and I would listen to it. In the day of the CD, when cars had CD players, I'd put the CD in. Now my cars don't have CD players, so I have access to the streaming services of Apple Music and other things, and I listen to it. And I actually have a device that I have in my car, which is called the buzzer. And this is all a part of the warming up. So as I'm driving on, so I'm kind of killing two birds with one stone there. And quite honestly, I really don't practice orchestral repertoire at home unless it's just the really difficult excerpts, passages. I will, you know, it's tone, it's flexibility, high range. You have to, people think a bass trombonist can't play in the high range. Wrong. If you can't play the high range, you'll never win an audition. Everyone can play low, but not everyone can play high. So I found out for me what I have to do on a daily basis. I tell you, when we do have new scores, such as we've just come through with the Lisée Percussion Concerto, then I am practicing that like crazy. Oh, it's just so, so hard. But standard repertoire, I've played it all many, many times, so I know what to expect. And by knowing what to expect, I know what's expected of me technically, and those are the elements that I work on. And another little tidbit, which I heard a long time ago from my admiration of the Chicago Symphony Brass Section. The principal trumpet player back then was Adolf Herseth, Bud Herseth. And I remember reading something, and he said, in terms of his own practice, if they're performing Mahler on stage 1 week, when he's at home practicing, he's practicing Mozart. When he's performing Mozart on stage with the orchestra, he's practicing Mahler. Not that he actually practices those pieces, but the styles associated with them, okay? So they're always practicing the opposites, and they end up averaging out.
That's great. Yeah, I do a little bit of that too. But I'm curious, is there like beautiful repertoire that you play or arrangements of things? I imagine it's a lot of technical drills, but do you play Bach? Cello suites?
I do. Yes, over and over and over and over again. Yes. Now, having said that, I do the Bach suites 1 through 5, and I skip the sixth because the sixth is written for, I think it's a 5-string cello, and I think it's tuned higher. And for the bass trombone tessitura, it's just a little too frustrating because you're really up there. But yes, Bach is I love Bach. And in my first, it's great that you mentioned that, because in my first lessons with Remington in that summer session, he introduced me to the cello suites of Bach. Now, keep in mind that was the early 1970s, and Emery Remington was totally over the moon with Pablo Casals and the way Pablo Casals played those Bach suites. And I have to admit that I tend to lean towards that romantic interpretation of these Bach suites. But the wonderful thing about Bach, and you would know much more than I would, is so many great cellists through these past decades bring their own vision of what Bach should sound like. You know, Janos Starker, who was a regular soloist with Nako in the early years, his Bach cello suites sound nothing like Casals, do they? Yeah. So, but yes, I will start the prelude of the first suite and go through first suite all the way through to the fifth and then back to the, and I'll do that. Yes. Yeah.
So do you also play like opera arias or songs?
Opera, no. I love opera. And I do know that there are many, many, many bass brass players that will play opera arias. And I know Arnold Jacobs used to do that. He used to do stuff from arias from Madama Butterfly and just revel in it. My melodic element and source comes from the Bordoni and similar vocalises, and also the churches that we've attended. I will often play solos during the offertory, so my melodies tend to be more hymn based and gospel song based, and there's a wonderful vast treasure of arrangements of that I've accumulated over the years and performed. So that's kind of where I tend to go for my melody. But my Bach, it feeds my musical soul for sure. Yeah, I just love Bach.
We talked earlier about being in the moment, and that when you're practicing, you want to be thinking that you're performing and you're feeling the music. But it's when we're practicing, we're also problem solving. So I always find that something that I'm teaching is you have to have performance mode and practice mode, so that when you decide you're in performance mode, you practice just playing as though for someone, you know what I mean? So that it's separate from stopping and fixing things and worrying about what just happened.
Okay, that's a very good question, and I need to break it down before I come up with an answer, because I think at this stage of my career, what I tend to do is look at the passage that is giving me problems. If it's, and I've also adopted the philosophy that if you have a problem once, it's going to happen again, because your musical instincts have led you to that moment, whether it's an interval which you're anticipating, but the composer said, no, I'm going to fool you, I'm going to go here and you want to go there, or the rhythm something. So I will sit back and cerebrally analyze what that problem was, maybe buzz it, sing it, and then go right to it, but slowly. Again, but it's with this, for me, taking away the word practice and inserting perform. Because when I expect a performance from myself, then my awareness is elevated, and I'm in the moment. Yes, there are and will be some technical passages which you do have to, in the brass world, and I don't know whether you're in the string, where you have to woodshed it, which you have to do by rote, by memory, and yes, those elements happen. For example, the storm scene in William Tell, because it's not chromatic. It sounds chromatic, but it's not. So yes, but trombonists tend not to have those challenging passages, which you as a violinist have on a regular basis, numerous times on every page. So I don't think that's how I approach my challenges. Yours are different. You would have, you would obviously have a different approach for sure.
So, as a mentor, as a teacher at a university, what kind of advice do you give people? I mean, the landscape is changing certainly in the orchestra business. I think there's maybe less security, fewer jobs than there used to be. What kind of perspectives do you give them on the kind of skills they should bring and expectations?
First of all, I don't encourage students to become performance majors at a university level, except with rare exceptions. And that's because of what you just said. There are fewer and fewer jobs. And the jobs that are out there, most of which are don't pay very, very well. And the benefits are okay. South of the border in the States, the pension that the AF of M have is non-existent. So if you are considering being a professional performer and you want to become a performance major, I know what my wife and I do. And I've done it three or four times with high school students, gifted high school students, who really want to be performance majors. I say, okay, come on over. We'll have coffee and tea, and bring your parents, and we'll sit around the dining room table, and I will present them. I will take the rose-colored glasses off and say, this is the reality of your chances of winning an audition, and paint the bleakest picture of reality that I can, so that they are going into it with that knowledge. Wendy, on the other hand, will then say, you have a future, and it's not going to be in isolation. You will end up with a partner. This is what your partner has to expect if you want your relationship to last, and she won't mince any words. And then we'll say, what are your questions? And the parents are there and say, you realize what costs are involved. Canadian universities benefit from great subsidization from government levels to reduce tuition costs. And there are many, many fine programs in Canada for sure. However, there's this pull and allure of great teaching and great experiences in the wonderful conservatories and schools and universities south of the border. But with that comes a huge economical cost. And to the parents, to those students, those are risks that you have to be willing to take, and you know the risks up front. And if having been told and are you familiar with them, if you still want to, then I will say I will put every bit of support and energy behind you that I can. But remember, you're the one that makes the sound. I can't do it for you. I can put you in, point you in the right direction, try to make sure that I don't do any harm, but you're the one that still has to do it. So it's, and yes, there are lots of students of mine that haven't made it into an orchestra, but that's not unusual. But I also, once they are in the educational system, I try to encourage them to become as versatile on so many things. Don't just be a bass trombonist, tenor trombone, contrabass trombone, arranging, conducting, having your own small studio of teaching, getting out into the community. If being a high school music teacher is something that interests you, then by all means. But that's a tough job, but having the versatility and a wide array of skill sets will enable people to still have a very fulfilling career in music. It might not be in a symphony orchestra, but they can still be performing.
Well, thanks so much for your time today and your sharing your perspectives and it's
Well,
just
thank
wonderful to
you
talk
for
to you.
asking such thoughtful questions. And, and I hope that those who are watching the podcast will be able to gain some sense of what it's like to live in the back row of an orchestra. And after 50 years, it's been such a pleasure and an honor to play with his orchestra. And I am sorry to leave, but life is short, and there are a few other things that I want to do other than what I've been able to enjoy so much and have such happy memories with NACO and with colleagues such as yourself, because it comes down to the people you work with, and that's what makes NACO so special. It's having friends and colleagues such as yourself.
My life is so enriched by getting to know these incredibly inspiring creative guests and their perspectives on their lives and music. Please follow this podcast and sign up for my podcast newsletter to get sneak peeks for upcoming guests and find out about newly published transcripts.